Good afternoon and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. Today is our third program dealing with the Alaska legal system. I have a co-host, Judge Elaine Andrews, as our legal expert. These shows have a special name. We call them Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. So far, over the last few months, we've featured a program explaining how Alaska chooses its judges and another on how to go about finding a lawyer when you need one. Today's program is called The Anatomy of a Criminal Case. You've been arrested and charged with a crime. What happens next? And what specific rules and responsibilities play out as the case moves to trial or through a trial? We've got the right people to explain it and discuss all the nuances. Before Judge Andrews introduces our top experts, let me remind our listeners that we welcome your questions and comments. You can give us a call at 550-8433 in Anchorage or 1-888-353-5752, that's statewide, or we can also take your email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So, Judge Andrews, why don't you introduce our guests?
Well, we have here in the studio Clint Campion, who's the Anchorage District Attorney, and Dunnington Babb, the Deputy Public Defender of the Criminal Division, both experts in their fields. Clint is, of course, the District Attorney, which means he is a prosecutor, and Mr. Babb is a public defender, which means he is on the defense side of a case, and I have often been in the middle between the two as a judge. So
the referee.
Yes, the referee. So it's a three-legged stool, and we're going to find out how it maintains its balance throughout the process.
So we're actually going to work our way through the process of a criminal case. But before we do that, I always like to find out from our guests, you know, a little bit about where they're from, why they chose this work. So Dunnington, let's ask you. From the public defender's office.
So I grew up here, born and raised here in Anchorage, Alaska. I guess I have to credit my parents for being a public defender. They raised us with some pretty consistent Catholic values that tie into.
Were they public defenders too?
No, but they support people that are less fortunate than them, and that was where kind of the values they raised us in. Mm-hmm. And then going to West High here in Anchorage, you got to see kind of two systems of justice between the west side of the border for West High School, which was very affluent, and the eastern border, which was not affluent.
Mm-hmm. Where'd you go to school?
For undergrad, I went to St. Mary's College of California and then University of San Francisco for law school.
Okay. And did you always know you were going to come back to Alaska, or was that a decision you made after law school?
I always knew that I would come back. I thought I would come back a little faster. I spent 5 years in California before I made it back.
Uh-huh. Okay. And so how about you, Clinton? What's your story?
So I grew up as the son of a law enforcement officer who spent nearly 40 years as a law enforcement officer in Minnesota, and that inspired me to want to be a prosecutor eventually. I spent time in the Army as a prosecutor, and I spent time as a defense lawyer in the Army, and then eventually made my way to Alaska with the Army and transitioned from prosecuting for the Army to prosecuting for the state of Alaska.
Mm-hmm. And is it typical that people might go back and forth between being a public defender? And Elaine, you were also a public defender at one point.
I was.
Yeah.
I was. I would say in past history, people often move from one side to the other. I think there's been less movement in more recent times. It would be pretty unusual to see that now. But that was the history of many lawyers here in the state, that they were either a prosecutor for a while and then went into defense or vice versa.
And it changed because why?
It's just the way it is.
Yeah.
I mean, if you know the criminal law, you know it from both sides. And so you could move from one side to the other. The criminal law is a pretty specialized area. And once you move out of it, it's hard to move between civil and criminal. It's easier to move within the criminal law.
Stay with what you know.
Exactly. And there's a lot to know.
Yes. By the way, I want to mention we have links on the site. We all met earlier and talked about what might be good to provide to the public. So we have various things on there, including the offices you serve from, but also some recent studies that were done on Alaska's criminal justice system. And so you would find them at alaskapublic.org and then just search for the Hometown Show. And we have about a dozen links. So if you get interested and you want to know more, you can always go there. So let's start off, Elaine, with talking about the beginning of a criminal case.
Well, I think most people would assume that you come into the criminal system via arrest or a citation from a police officer, and that's generally the way things happen. But it happens a little bit differently in different parts of the state. So let's assume you're in Anchorage and you're driving your car, an officer pulls you over and thinks either that you might be under the influence of alcohol or saw you driving recklessly. Let me ask Clint, how does the officer determine whether to arrest you or not, and how does a person get charged? Is it the police officer who decides the charge? Is it the district attorney? How does that work?
Well, assuming that the police officer has determined that an arrest is warranted under the law, then the police officer will make the original or initial charging decision in terms of arresting someone. But typically in Anchorage, what happens is within 24 hours, either the prosecutor's office of either the state or the municipality will review that decision and then determine what charges, if any, should be filed. And that person would then appear before a judge or magistrate to determine if there's probable cause to support the charge or charges that have been filed.
So that is that what there's a word that people use that's called an arraignment? Is that the process we're talking
right,
about?
Right. There would be an arraignment that would take place typically within 24 hours of the arrest.
So if you are arrested, for example, and the officer determines that this is reckless driving and decides there's a reason to arrest you for reckless driving, and you look at what the officer has given you he writes out a police report, I'm assuming, and you read the police report. If you're in your opinion, you think that it looks more like negligent driving, or you think that there's enough, maybe waiting for results to come back from toxicology for a DWI, can you change what the police officer has decided?
We can. The range of options that we have based on the information that's provided to us initially is we can agree with the charges and we can file charges that correspond to the officer's assessment. We could up the charges if we thought there were things that the officer missed. That doesn't happen that often. But very frequently, we would either disagree entirely or disagree with some of the charges that the officer had referred to us or had based the arrest on, and we would make a decision not to pursue those charges. And so that would change the perspective for that defendant who would be at the arraignment, who may find out no charges have been filed or lesser charges have been filed.
So the person is arrested. They're sitting in jail. They know they're going to see a judicial officer within 24 hours. And at that point, they will learn what they're truly charged with. And Dunnington, where do you come into this process? Do you know when someone lands in jail immediately? How do you find out that there is someone who might be seeking the appointment of a public defender or that you might be coming into a case?
We are appointed by the judge at the arraignment, and typically in most jurisdictions throughout Alaska, the public defender is not at that initial arraignment. So we won't know that we have this client until after they've gone before the judge and entered their not guilty plea and asked the court for a public defender. And then the court has to make a financial determination that you're qualified to have a public defender.
Do you often find yourself at arraignments, maybe for another client that you know is going to be your client, and there are people there who are being appointed? Do you ever have an opportunity to talk to people at that stage, or they really can't talk to a public defender until they've seen a judge and been financially qualified for an appointment?
So since I became the deputy and gotten to see all of the jurisdictions now, I'm very encouraged to see that it happens much more often in the small offices and the small communities around the state. The structure of the large communities such as Anchorage, the arraignments take place generally at the jail. If you've been picked up, for instance, on a DUI suspicion that we were describing earlier, you'll often be picked up, spend the night in jail, you'll get arraigned at the jail, and there generally is not there is not a public defender at that hearing. So from there, the judge will arraign the client, appoint the public defender, and we expect to have contact with them no later than the end of the next day.
Okay. And what would happen? So the person is charged. They now know what their charge is. They've gone in front of the judge. Do they, unrepresented, ask for some bail consideration? Is that up to them as an unrepresented person to ask for a reduction in bail, or what happens?
Generally, once the court makes that appointment, they won't discuss any legal matters because the person is now represented. They are represented by the public defender, even though they unfortunately don't have an individual attorney advocating for them in that moment. So once the appointment takes place, it is exceedingly rare that the court will have a dialogue with the client about legal rights moving forward.
So you now get notice that you have been appointed to John Doe. And what happens next? Do you go to the jail to see them? Do you set on a bail hearing? What happens next?
The public defender now has a huge priority in getting down to the jail and making that initial contact. That is often, even though it's about a mile and a half from the public defender's office to the Anchorage jail, that is often a pretty large undertaking, getting access to the client in custody. But at a minimum, if you can't have that enhanced attorney-client meeting in a private room, you can at least gain access to them through the glass in a general meeting upstairs to say, hey, I'm your attorney. People can hear what's going on, so don't describe the facts of your case, but tell me about your general bail consideration so we can try and get you out of jail.
Okay. And then you would schedule a bail hearing.
Correct. Okay. And that generally your first bail hearing you can obtain within 48 hours of applying for it. So that first bail hearing is pretty significant. You then have to wait a full week and bring up new issues in order to have access to a second bail hearing. So that first bail hearing comes quickly and is your generally a person's best opportunity to get out of custody.
And Clint, would you be at that bail hearing? And what considerations would come to the fore for you?
Yes, for any bail hearing for any of our cases, we would have one of the prosecutors present. If there's a victim of a crime and the crime or crimes alleged, then they have an opportunity to participate in the bail hearing, and it's our obligation to let them know not only that there will be a bail hearing, but what's being proposed so that they have a chance to think about it and provide input to the judge.
And could you delay a bail hearing if the victim said, you just called me this afternoon, I can't be at the bail hearing tomorrow morning? Do you have the opportunity to ask the court to delay the bail hearing so the victim could be there?
You know, it's possible that we could do that, but we offer alternate ways for the alleged victim to be able to participate. It may be that they can call from work or they can provide a written statement or other means. But generally, once the court schedules it, it generally takes place when it's scheduled.
All right. And this is a question for either one of you. What's the purpose of bail? What would the prosecutor be arguing for in bail, and what would the defense be arguing for in bail?
So the primary factors from the prosecutor's perspective are to ensure the continued appearance of the defendant at subsequent hearings so that we can keep the criminal justice system moving forward in that particular case. So appearance is important to determine if they're going to show up or not. And then the other very important consideration is the continued danger that a defendant might pose to the public. And that we look at a lot of different factors to determine the likelihood that person would reoffend and cause a danger or potential danger to the community.
And Dunnington, what things would you be bringing up to the court to either get bail reduced or eliminated? What kinds of flexibility or creative solutions might a defense attorney present to the court to meet that twin goal of ensuring the person's appearance and ensuring the safety of the community while they're out on release?
Generally, an important consideration is for the judge to understand ties to the community. I think that's the language that's most commonly thrown around at a bail hearing or even at an arraignment, that a client has too much invested, children, family, job, home, too much invested in the community to leave it and to risk running away from their legal obligations. And then it is an analysis of public safety risk. And there is just such a large percentage of cases that come through the Alaska court system that are in the moment events, meaning that they're not going to be repeated. The dispute between two strangers in a bar, if you keep those two people apart, they're not going to have that dispute. So that person's not in danger, the complaining witness in that situation. So what you're trying to highlight for the court is these are easy things to fix to keep client X out of jail and keep the community safe and to assure that they're going to attend the next hearing. The judges are empowered with a wide range of behavioral conditions they can apply. No alcohol, they can impose curfews. There's all sorts of things that they can do to address concerns about what might cause a defendant to violate the law between now and their court hearing.
You sometimes hear this phrase, third-party custodian. What is that?
Third-party custodian was a great idea with a good intention. My understanding of the history, and it's from a biased side, certainly, the history was that in a lot of rural communities, even to this day, there is not access to bail bonds. Sureties won't insure bond for companies in communities as large as Dillingham, a lot of the villages around Bethel, a great percentage of the state of Alaska. So getting your hands on a bail bondsman is incredibly difficult. And so the fix was to allow a seasonal worker to go with his captain and go fishing for the summer. You know where he's going to be. You know he's going to be removed from both the complaining witness and kind of the location of the action. And so the court has a good sense that the public will be safe and the client at the end of the season will be back to face his charges. Unfortunately, I personally think, and I think that we've seen this certainly coming out of the research that fed into SB 91, that the third-party custodian requirement is tacked on to a lot of situations where it's not necessary. And I wish that I had a better handle on the statistics. I believe it's as much as 75% of cases that have a third-party custodian requirement, the client is not released from custody.
Okay.
I have a question. I'm interested in how the amount for bail is set. I mean, sometimes it seems really a big, high number. How is it based on the resources of the person who's asking for bail, or how do you set bail?
Well, having set more bails, more bails than I could possibly count, it is a combination of what would be an amount that a person would not want to lose. For a very wealthy person and a serious crime, they might be willing to leave a great deal of money on the table. And for a much poorer person, $50 could be a lot of money. So it's that along with the seriousness of the crime. But it is that whole, the bail really is focused on appearance and protection of the public. And those bail decisions are made ordinarily very quickly. I certainly...
From your experience.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, even for felonies, I for a long time did arraignments for felonies every day. And so I would have up to 6 or 7 people for whom I had to decide bail on a felony matter. And, it might be 4 minutes, 5 minutes. The hearing is an hour, and that's...
And, of course, bail is about having people not be in jail while they're waiting for their trial. Would you say that the prosecutor's office and the public defender's office, given there's no threat to the community, they're both working to get this person out of not in jail? Or no, you don't see it the same way? Seeing a shaking head, yeah.
My perspective as a prosecutor is that we evaluate each proposal and each bail situation, and there are certainly many times where we would agree that it's in the interests of the community to place some restrictions on a person and to get them out on bail because we don't think they need to be in jail, and there's no societal interest that's going to be advanced by that. But there are also times where that hearing that the judge is describing becomes very adversarial, and prosecutors and defense attorneys do what we do, which is we argue our position and then let the judge decide.
Leave it to the judge to decide, right. Yeah. So you're not necessarily on the same side. Given there's no threat to the community, you still wouldn't be on the same side. Given some circumstances in a case, you might still be arguing that they should go to jail.
Sure.
Yeah. I want to throw out our phone numbers one more time. If you just joined us, we are talking about the anatomy of a criminal case, and we have Judge Elaine Andrews here as a legal expert and co-host, and we have Clinton Campion, district attorney for the 3rd Judicial District, I think I got that right, and Dunnington Babb, who's the deputy public defender. And you can give us, we welcome your questions. Maybe you've had an experience that you want to talk about or find out more about the process. 550-8433 in Anchorage or 1-888-353-5752, that's statewide, or you can email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. I had a question before the show. Could you end up with a misdemeanor and go to a trial? I mean, because misdemeanor seems small to me. Does that warrant a trial?
Oh, yes. I mean, a misdemeanor is a case in which you could get up to a year in jail. So it's not...
Minor.
It's not minor. It okay. is not a traffic ticket for which there's no jail time attached. So, yes, misdemeanors go to trial
frequently.
Frequently. Mm-hmm. They have significant consequences for people. For example, a DUI could have tremendous consequences for someone in terms of their insurance rates, their ability to get or keep a job, their ability to drive in the future. So these are
heavy.
Even though it's a misdemeanor, it is a serious criminal charge. It's not an infraction.
In a first DWI, would that be a misdemeanor always, or does it depend on others? You know, whether there was an accident or maybe injuries. Is it possible to speculate that way or not?
Well, typically, under Alaska statutes, the first DUI that someone would be charged with would be treated as a misdemeanor. There's a possibility there would be other offenses, and we will sometimes see that happen. For example, someone may have struck another driver or another pedestrian, and that could create an assault situation where that could become a felony. Sometimes we see other crimes associated with the DUI, for example, drug possession or other things like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And in Alaska, we have issues around alcohol. Has anybody ever tried to make it more than a misdemeanor, or is it always just it's in the law that way?
The first one is always a misdemeanor, but there's a provision in statute that if you get convicted multiple times after your second conviction, your third arrest would then be treated as a felony.
Mm-hmm.
So then the penalties go up and the collateral consequences long-term go up as well for that mm-hmm. person.
Yeah, every now and then there'll be a case in the paper of someone who has been convicted of DUI, and then they're out driving without their license and they're drunk or something crazy like that. You know, it still happens, right? I mean, there's just, even though you try to sort it out, comb it out, it still can get away.
Well,
yeah. But that's a common one for Alaska, I guess.
I think it's probably common everywhere. Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because eventually, well, I mean, their licenses are suspended, but it doesn't physically restrain them from getting into a car, although the penalties for driving on a suspended license are, once again, severe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But once you've now been, and one of the things we talk about in bail is that if you are out on bail, I think probably both attorneys would agree, it helps facilitate the further processing of a case. In other words, if a person stays in jail, things tend to slow down, I think, because the ability for the defense attorney to access their client to prepare for trial gets slowed down somewhat. But let's assume for purposes of discussion you have someone who has been arrested, they've been charged, they have gone to a bail hearing. Bail in some form has been arranged such that the person is out of custody. When does a trial get set in Anchorage, just on an average misdemeanor case? And misdemeanors are different than felonies. Felonies are much more serious and take more time. But if the average misdemeanor from the day you're arrested until the day you are likely to have a trial, Dunnington, do you have any sense of that?
So from the date of arraignment, generally a misdemeanor in Anchorage at least is calendared approximately 6 weeks out for what's called a pretrial, which is meant to be that first appearance before the court to let the judge know what information the defense has, what information the prosecution has, whether they think there's a possibility of a resolution, and whether there's outstanding information called discovery, any kind of facts or evidence that the prosecuting agency or the police department instruments of the prosecuting agency have gathered in the prosecution. And from there, it's possible in Anchorage, if the two parties are satisfied with the information that they have, that you could have a trial 10 days from then. You could get on the trial call, which is the following Thursday for a Monday trial. A Tuesday trial.
Okay. So it happens pretty quickly in misdemeanor land. On a felony, if a person is charged with a serious felony, when could the accused and the public expect, Clint, that a serious felony would go to trial? What's the average kind of time that it takes to work up from both the prosecution and defense?
Well, for felonies in Anchorage, and I don't think the experience is that much different statewide. Our goal is certainly to get a felony trial, a case to trial within a year. And we're, for more serious cases, something longer than that. There's a certain number of cases on any given day, and there are cases added and deleted from that list for a variety of reasons on it. And so you're constantly shuffling and triaging the cases based on a lot of different factors.
Okay, so if there's a speedy trial rule that says a person has the right to go to trial within 120 days, but it takes a year for a felony to get to trial, how does that work? How can that happen?
The starting point is that the prosecutor's office is responsible for making sure that the prosecutor and the defense attorney have all the information available that's relevant to the case. And that can sometimes take time. The best example would be sometimes we rely on the state crime lab to provide us with more information. And the state crime lab has gone a long way in improving their processing time, but that can be a factor. And often in the serious cases, both sides, but in particular, the defense attorney wants to litigate issues that are important in the ultimate outcome. And that process takes time, and that involves the judge, and that's something short of trial. So that process can take sometimes months to get those issues resolved, because that may involve a fair amount of legal briefing and hearings where the judge has to hear from witnesses.
Okay.
So, Eileen, we have a question. Would it be a good time to interject it?
Sure.
Came in by email, and it says, thanks for having the show. A crucial part of many cases is taking a statement from a suspect. Alaska courts and the courts of most states allow police to lie and use tricks in their efforts to extract a confession. The leading case in Alaska is called Savalik. Many other countries do not allow this, and many people here are surprised when they find out we do allow it. Does the end justify the means, and can't most cases be made without these tactics? Well, definitely has a point of view here. So what do you think?
Let me ask Dunnington if he has an opinion.
If I understand the framing of the question, I think my answer is yes. I think that justice can be reached without using these tactics. Mm-hmm. But it is legal in the United States and in Alaska to... More concerning, I think, than some of the dishonesty is the psychological intimidation that is put on a person that's been taken into a closed room and is then surrounded by often physically intimidating people for long periods of time. There has been just a lot of cases over the years. Again, I hate to use imperfect statistics, but I believe it's as many as 28% of the Innocence Project cases that are overturned by DNA. Where you determine that DNA tells us that person wasn't there, that person didn't commit that crime, there were confessions made by the person that was wrongly incarcerated.
Which seems hard to imagine. I mean, why would you admit to something you didn't do? But
the common thread from those people is, I just wanted to get out of the room. And since I wasn't there and since I didn't do it, I knew that the justice system would get it right. But then they head to trial with a confession, and that is very difficult to overcome.
What about that thing about being told you can call a lawyer? When does that happen? I mean, this is the Miranda rights, I guess. And so could you get in a situation where you're being in a little room pressured and you haven't had the chance to call an attorney?
You can, but that is a more clearly protected situation. If you're not given the opportunity, you're not read your Miranda rights, the Alaska court system does very well in getting rid of those cases by a motion to suppress, by getting rid of that information that was offered against your will without knowing your right to an attorney. Mm-hmm.
Hmm. So, Clint, what is your response to that?
My response would be that the law enforcement officers that I've worked with in Alaska are across the board, with very few exceptions, very professional and very aware of what the United States Supreme Court and the Alaska Supreme Court have required for rules that apply to interrogations and interviews with suspects. And I think that as a general rule, they adhere not only to providing Miranda warnings, typically off of a card so that it's the same every time and it's consistent with what the law requires, but they also scrupulously honor, for the most part, the invocation of rights by a suspect, and they're aware of it. And it's so my perspective is that I agree with Mr. Babb that the courts have done a good job when there are cases that where there are very clear violations. But I would also suggest to you that the police do a good job themselves overall in training their officers and making sure that they adhere to the law, the current law, and that prosecutors play a role in that. And when we we are typically more involved in the more serious cases, and we're looking at the issues such as interrogations or interviews very carefully. And we're also making recommendations to the police that this may be someone we don't charge because of those issues. But often those issues are resolved by a judge, and we litigate both sides, and we ultimately will ask the judge to make a decision based on the propriety or impropriety of the officer's conduct. Mm.
And as a judge, I can say the one thing that I have seen that has changed over the course of a couple decades is that in Alaska, those statements are required to be recorded. So early in my career, you were arguing about what the police said or didn't say and what the defendant said or didn't say. But now they're recorded. And so
it's
on the record. And that mm-hmm. makes the decision for the judge much easier and more likely to be correct than a controversy over about people's recollection of what happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, we really do need to take a quick little break here. We have a lot to talk about. We wanted to get to plea bargaining, which is a testy subject, right? And jury selection, the art and science of that. So we're talking with Judge Elaine Andrews, co-host and legal expert on Justice Alaska. We have Prosecutor Clinton Campion and Public Defender Dunnington Babb with us. We're going to take just a brief break and be right back and pick up with the anatomy of a criminal case.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. It's actually Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska, a special edition of Hometown Alaska. I'm here with Judge Elaine Andrews, Prosecutor Clinton Campion, and Public Defender Dunnington Babb. And we're sort of walking our way through the process of, we're calling it the anatomy of a criminal case. And we were just, where were we? Where do we want to pick back up from?
Well, we were talking about the fact that there are motions pre-trial that people may have a motion to suppress a confession and that the parties exchange information, that in Alaska there is very open and liberal discovery. In other words, everything that comes to the prosecutor's office goes over to the defense. So there are
and vice versa?
No.
No. Okay.
No. No. It's a one-way street on that. And I think the theory behind that is that you have the power of the state prosecuting someone who doesn't have access to the power or the information. So it is not a two-way street. But the discovery is given. Pre-trial motions are filed.
Could we talk a little bit about what discovery is? That interviews with people, or is it evidence? What is discovery?
It's police reports. Maybe Clint can fill in.
And I think the nature of discovery has changed. The best example is what Judge Andrews talked about, that we have recorded interviews, and so we have recordings. And so there's a lot of digital media. Another area that's really emerging, especially recently, is the presence of surveillance videos and who has them privately or in their residences or at homes. There's an attempt to try to obtain that because it can often tell us a lot more about an event. And the other area that's emerging dramatically is with cell phones and smartphones and the amount of information that's there. And often it takes somebody with some specialized training to understand what they're looking at with some of the forensic reports that are provided from those devices. So those kinds of things not only take a while to sometimes obtain, but also a while to review and understand in the context of whatever allegations are pending.
I'm thinking of your phone and a traffic accident and texting. Were you texting? I mean, that's the kind of thing someone might be looking into.
That's the an obvious example. But with really serious cases, particularly I'm thinking of homicides, there are examples where people are communicating with folks or phones can tell you where someone was or was not at a time and other information that they may have had or not had prior to an event.
Do you find people to be very naive about that? I'm talking about people in the world who might be confronted with an accusation? Are they naive about how much is known in their whereabouts with their phone?
My response would be, I don't think that people are naive. I just don't think they realize there's just
They haven't thought it out.
They haven't thought through or processed what the relevance of that information might be in the context of whatever the allegations are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me throw out our phone numbers. I want to make sure people, if they have a question, they feel free to call us at 550-8433 in Anchorage or 1-888-353-5752 statewide and email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So anyway, where were we?
So Dunnington, you have a client who is... you've now gotten discovery. You've gotten the information that the prosecutor has given you, and it's time for you to have a discussion with your client about trial or a plea. Why would you take someone to trial? Why would you counsel someone for a plea? And how is that arranged? Who
negotiates?
Yes. How does this happen?
That can end up being stylistic from attorney to attorney. I think as a general proposition, there is a lot of value for the defense attorney to initiate the conversation with the prosecutor after having had an informed conversation with their client. For a client, the decision is risk tolerance generally. The nature of criminal charges, even what we were discussing earlier with law enforcement identifying charges that there is a reason that that there are district attorneys and that there are police officers and law enforcement, that there is specialized knowledge required for a district attorney to understand what facts are necessary to move a case forward. What can often happen in a direct file, meaning that law enforcement has filed the charges, is it can be overcharged, meaning that you committed a second-degree offense and you're charged with a first-degree offense. And so a client has to evaluate, are they willing to take the chance at trial that they're going to get convicted for this higher charge that they have good facts for arguing I'm innocent of crime one, I'm actually crime second degree, and that's what I want to pursue. And so the client has to figure out what the facts are, and they can't do that without their counsel. So the counsel has to be able to tell them, this is what I expect the facts will show. The challenging thing for a client is a jury trial truly is a gamble, and even the best facts can result in a conviction, and the worst facts can result in an acquittal. So you try and do your best to help the client understand that you think you have the client has a great shot at success at trial, but that they're risking 5 years in jail versus no jail with the state's offer. And those are the things that the client has to evaluate. And once you have an understanding of the client's threshold, it becomes, I think, a huge setback to negotiations will be, hey, can you get this resolution for my client? And the district attorney goes and asks permission from Clint, if we're using Anchorage as an example. And Clint gives permission to resolve a case at that level. And then he comes back and the client says, I've changed my mind. Mm. I want to get less. And it's very hard to motivate then to go back and plead the new case to Clint why you have to give a sweeter deal. And so it's important for your client to understand as much as possible about a situation before that negotiation process begins with the district attorney.
And Clint, what's your experience in terms of the caseload in the Anchorage area and that's the one you're most familiar with, so I don't mean to exclude the rest of the state, but it's something that you know. Of the number of cases that come in, what percentage go to trial? What percentage plead?
So in any given year, we have thousands of felonies and thousands of misdemeanors that our office handles. And over the last 10 or 12 years, we did not more than 175 jury trials in a year. So the numbers suggest that well in excess of 90% of the cases that are referred to us are cases that we resolve through plea bargain or some other mechanism. And that's a necessity in order to be able to manage the caseload, not just for our office or for the public defenders, but for the court system and the potential jurors that would have to hear those cases. And much like Mr. Babb said, we have to engage in those negotiations early on to see which cases can and may not resolve.
And what technically is a plea bargain? What does that really mean? In other words, you're charged with an assault. What is the product of the negotiation between the prosecutor and the defense? What does it look like, and what gets presented to the judge?
There are often cases where there's more than one charge or there are serious charges, and the way that a plea bargain could be presented would be that the state or the prosecutor would agree to modify or reduce the charges pending, and that there could be a benefit to the defendant for that. In connection with that, we may offer a sentence agreement where there's a firm sentence agreement that we present to the judge together. Other times, there are other modifications that we try to accommodate, not just what is in the defendant's best interest, but what we think the law would require for a particular set of facts, and importantly, what a victim's input would be. We are required to consider that in the vast majority of plea agreements.
And is a plea bargain always a charge and a sentence, or could you do just a plea bargain on the charges and leave the sentencing to the judge?
We can do that, and over the last number of years, that was an approach that we took where we entered into charge bargains and then left the sentencing up to the judge entirely. Overall, our experience with that was that we were hopeful that the judge would have a lot of information and would be able to make the decision, and generally that was true, but it did increase the amount of resources necessary to get to that point because it involved the Department of Corrections would get involved with a pre-sentence investigation and providing more information to the judge. And that would be an open hearing where that would take time for the court to hear both sides, hear from witnesses, and then make decisions on sentencing.
And Dunnington, is there anything that you think that the public should know about the plea bargaining process?
That's a pretty open question.
Lots of things.
I think if you take the time to scroll through the commentary, which an attorney with an active case should never do, but if you scroll through the commentary on an online article about a publicized crime in Alaska, you'll generally see outrage that a case was reduced or resolved. And I think it's probably important for the public to understand in the scenario that we described earlier, and I haven't been able to latch on the right actual charge. If someone is charged with, let's call it misconduct involving a controlled substance in the second degree, which relates to opiates, it's called mixed two as a shorthand. And then there's mixed three, which is non-opiate drug sale or possession for sale. If someone is charged with a mixed two, the opiate sale, which carries a much higher penalty, when in fact they didn't have opiates, they had cocaine, that's a crime, and that's a very serious crime. But they are innocent of a mixed two. And so I think when the public looks at why was this charge bargained or why did this guilty person get to do this or get an easier sentence, it's important to understand that factually they may be innocent of the higher charge. Factually, the facts may not be there to establish that a crime was committed at all, but the client decided they weren't willing to take that risk. There is so much information that is not available on a quick one-paragraph article in the paper that I think the public would do well to maybe come watch a trial or watch a hearing before they judge how the court system or the justice system has resolved a particular set of facts.
Well, I have to say that is something that I have always invited people to do. The courtrooms are open except for children's cases, and there is no courtroom that you can't walk into in this state, actually, or in this country. It's the hallmark of our justice system. Mm-hmm. And to see the careful, thoughtful, hard work that goes into the processing of cases and the careful judgment on everyone's side and the hard work that the advocates do to try and come to an understanding of what the real truth is, and it is a hard, difficult process. And
Clint, before the show, you and I were just chatting here, waiting for getting ready, and you had talked about difficult conversations you have. We talked about 90% of the cases don't go to trial, so that's a lot of conversations you have with people explaining what happened, you know, why this person isn't going to be charged or why this agreement was made. I guess I thought that was an opportunity. People don't, we're kind of talking about how people aren't party to this and yet hard decisions are made, and you're in the position a lot of times to try to explain it to people. Is there any way you can help people understand it, or is it too specific to each case?
Obviously, it's specific to each case, and there are a lot of cases that we handle where the victims of the crimes feel very strongly that they want to see the most rigorous sentence that we could impose.
Throw the book at them.
Right? Well, that's a shorthand. And I would say that there's an equal number of victims of crimes, legitimate victims of crimes, who don't want us to prosecute the case for one reason or another. And so when we talk about victim input, we're taking input from both categories, and sometimes people that have mixed feelings or are indifferent. And so that's one of the points that we have to evaluate. But we do have those conversations. And
that's probably a hard part of your job. I mean,
most of that falls upon our victim witness paralegals that are the front lines of those communications. And then in the more significant cases where the attorney really is invested in the case and has a relationship with the victims or the victim's family, then it's a different kind of conversation. And then another factor, of course, is, you know, the police invest a lot of time and resources in cases, and we need to be considerate of their input. And they certainly don't want to have the feeling that they've invested a lot into a case only to see the prosecutor's office not pursue it vigorously.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that is important to understand is the role that each person has. And I do think that the public gets confused about what role does the jury have, what role does the prosecutor have, what role does the defense have, and what role does the judge have. So, you know, our hour is going to be up before we even get to, to some of those things.
Yeah.
But I think it's fair to say that the prosecution is in charge of the charging decision. The judges don't decide what a person gets charged with. The judges are in charge of the sentencing. In other words, you can come, you and Dunnington could come to the court with a plea bargain and say, this is what, as the prosecutor, I think the appropriate charge is. I have an agreement with the defense attorney. We think this is the appropriate sentence. You do it, judge. The judge is not required to accept your plea bargain. The judge can approve it and go along with your agreement, or the judge can reject it. That's correct.
Absolutely.
Okay. So the sentencing is ultimately up to the judge. But the question of guilt or innocence is 99.9% a jury question in the criminal arena. There's the occasional trial to a judge in a criminal case, but those are very few and far between. So there really are different roles that each person plays.
We were talking earlier about how people might encounter the criminal justice system, maybe as a victim, maybe as a juror, or maybe being charged with something. But probably the biggest group is perhaps, well, I'm not sure, maybe it is victims, but certainly lots of people get jury notice. And I'm really, I feel like there's so many TV shows, we talked about this, you know, the drama around the jury and the science and the art of selecting jurors. And we had an interesting discussion about, you know, a prosecutor, what your relationship is while you're thinking about, you're looking at these people. I hope we can talk a little bit about that if you think so.
Well, we're moving now, saying most cases don't go to trial, but the ones that do, virtually all of them have a jury. And if it's a misdemeanor, it's 6 people. And if it's a felony, it's 12 people. And so jurors are a necessary, critical piece. And you folks have had a depth and breadth of jury selection. Have either one of you served as a juror, just out of curiosity?
I have not served as a juror. I got a jury notice yesterday, though, so I'm expecting to serve this summer.
I tried very diligently on a civil case last year. And I think I would have been a fine juror, but I was rejected, unfortunately.
Well, and I should say that judges are not excused from jury service. I have been called, but I have not been selected to serve. So I'd love to be able to sit. I have sat as a judge trying a case where I've had another judge sit as a juror. So judges do occasionally get
selected. How did that feel?
I felt like a student teacher with the principal watching me. I was a brand new judge, and the judge sitting on the jury was an experienced superior court judge, and I really did feel like a student teacher with my principal sitting in the jury box.
So sometimes they end up on the jury.
Sometimes they do.
Yeah. Well, could we talk about the art and science of jury selection and what you're thinking about and what you're looking for in a juror or looking to avoid? I don't know. Is that something we could, from both sides, defense and attorney, what do you think?
Absolutely. I am looking for people that are prepared to pay attention and listen to the factual scenario. It's very easy, I think, not having the experience as a juror. I get the impression it's very easy to come in and see the person that's been accused of a crime and think, he must have done something wrong to get here. And that's where most of the conversations start around voir dire.
Voir dire.
Excuse me. That's jury selection.
Okay.
And so I am looking for people that are simply willing to withhold judgment until they have all the information, and probably comparable to the prosecution, I'm looking for people that want to follow the law, because the law requires that you have a significant amount of information and a significant amount of evidence before you make the decision to deprive someone of liberty. And so as long as the person that I'm speaking to is prepared to listen and evaluate the facts objectively without bias from their personal experience and hold the state to its incredibly high burden, those are generally jurors that we want.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Clinton? What are you looking for?
I would certainly echo what Mr. Babb said. What I would add, though, is as a prosecutor, I'm looking for predictability. That is, I have a sense of, I know what the charges are. I know what I think the law, how the law explains those charges and the other related jury instructions. And I want to have confidence that what the instructions are that the judge will give will be the ones followed by the jurors. In addition to that, you certainly want people to be able to pay attention. And there are certainly people that are not able to serve for a variety of reasons. And that's sort of the science of it. I think the judge, the defense attorney, the prosecutor are all looking for those people that just can't serve because of their personal experiences. And that's generally fairly easy for us to root out. But the art is the next step. And then you're looking to try to make a connection with jurors and make sure that you're not turning them off because of your personality or your approach. And you're trying to read that, and you're reading it through body language. You're reading it through the answers that you receive or the answers you don't receive. And that really is an art.
And from a judicial point of view, you're a neutral. You're just keeping the process moving, trying to make efficient use of the jurors' time. People always say, well, how is it that I keep getting selected? Jurors are drawn from the permanent fund application pool. So if you apply for a permanent fund check, you are likely to get a jury summons. So we are an equal opportunity selector. So if you get called more often than the average person, that's simply...
It doesn't mean you get more PFD checks.
No, it doesn't mean you get more PFD checks. But the one thing I think in my experience I have always heard is even if jurors start out reluctantly, they're not interested in jury service, they don't really want to serve, sometimes they get selected and you can kind of look at their face thinking, oh, you know, I was hoping I wouldn't get selected. Uniformly at the end of a trial, jurors report to me it was one of the most interesting, important experiences of their life, that they really come away from the justice system with a renewed respect and and are glad that they had the opportunity. So it is important, and we need committed, interested, capable jurors.
I think people should think, if I was being accused, I'd want them awake and paying attention. You know, you want them to be alert. And so it's a jury of your peers sort of thing. So, yeah. One thing we talked about in advance just a little bit was that people, and I don't know if this is jurors, it's just people maybe observing, but can be confused that the defense and the prosecuting attorneys seem to be friends. You know, they seem to talk a lot. Aren't they on opposite sides? We had a little bit of discussion about that, and I thought that might be a good thing to just talk a little bit about. What is your – I know that a lot of the negotiating you have to do means you have to have relationships across the aisle, so to speak. So what do you try to put on a face when you're in trial of, you know, or do you try to be the prosecutor or try to be the public defender, or do you just do your job and sometimes you're having casual conversation with the attorney for the other side? How does it work?
So I've done a couple trials with Clint, and we get along well together, and I generally anticipate going into the courtroom that we're going to be professional. It's my experience that being professional is a positive outcome for your client. But I will generally make sure that my client's comfortable. I'll let them know that I have a working relationship with the prosecutor and that I will be speaking with them in a comfortable way. And if they don't want me to do that, they have to tell me. And generally my clients understand that it is more successful and more likely to help them if I conduct myself professionally and give me permission to
be friendly. So you actually ask permission. That's interesting. Yeah. How about you, Clinton?
I don't have the same dynamic with a client. Sometimes police officers may be confused about that, but the more experienced ones understand that that's just part of the relationship. I think, and I certainly will defer to Judge Andrews for her perspective, but it's been the feedback that I've received, especially in trials I've done with Mr. Babb or other people like him, that the jurors have a much better experience when the prosecutors are focused on the critical issues and they're professional to the jurors, to each other, to the judge. I think the judge appreciates that, that it allows the judge to focus not on petty rivalries or drama, but rather what are the critical issues that need to be resolved by the judge and the jury. I think it's more efficient and expeditious. We get to the decision the jury needs to make without any of the distractions that might be available if the folks aren't, the prosecutor and the defense attorney aren't getting along. So I really strive to be professional and try to have a good working relationship that it's not chummy necessarily, but it's certainly friendly and warm so that we can exchange information and move the trial along.
Mm-hmm. And I would add that I've never gotten great offers from the prosecutors that do hate me. So there's certainly value to the client in having a professional relationship.
I make friends well. That's good.
Well, and judges are, you know, they, it is an adversarial process, but the adversarial nature is meant to be between the people who represent two sides of the aisle, not the people themselves. So the judges really do not like the attorneys sniping at one another that's personal, because that's not what, you know, people have an expectation when they see TV. There's a lot of drama and a lot of unprofessional conduct that you see on TV that would not be tolerated in a courtroom. So,
as judge, would you like take five? Like everybody, let's just take a little break here. I mean, do you see tensions build?
And tensions do build even with the best of attorneys, because they are adversaries. But good attorneys don't get into it with each other on a personal basis. And when you start to see things unravel, yes, oftentimes a recess is called for. Let everyone kind of step back and start again.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I just am curious, because those are things people would see and might not understand, because you're all part of the judicial system, but they are not. They're on the outside. So I wondered about that.
So when we get to, now we've selected a jury, they've reached a decision, and now if the decision is adverse to the defendant, then there's going to be a sentencing. So then we don't sentence right from the bench. We get a pre-sentence report, and that then has another hearing where we have an adversarial argument on both sides, along with the victims have a right to speak, and the judge has an obligation to consider.
Would you say the judge's most important role is the sentencing, or is it all the way along? You're really watching the law, and
I think it's all the way along, because you have to have a level playing field and a fair process to get a correct result.
Yeah, because things can be thrown out, right?
Yes.
And that's pretty difficult, probably from the judge's perspective, to have. Yes. Oh, topic for another show. Right? All right. It goes by really fast. And there's things we didn't even get to. So I'd really like to thank our guest today. This is Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. We had Judge Elaine Andrews as our co-host and legal expert. And the prosecutor was Clinton Campion. Public defender was Dunnington Babb. Next week, I will be back as your host on Hometown Alaska. We're going to meet the managing director of Launch Alaska, a local business accelerator working on diversifying the Alaska economy by giving a boost to some good business ideas. We'll hear about the five companies they'll accelerate this summer. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Dave Waldron is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for joining us today on this edition of Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.